Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Ian Goldberg. He's the chief scientist of Zero Knowledge Systems, a Canadian privacy technology company. He was a founding member of UC Berkeley's Internet Security Applications, Authentication, and Cryptography Group. His research currently interests include cryptography, security, and privacy. Dr. Goldberg was known for his part in cracking the first RSA secret key challenge in only 3.5 hours, breaking Netscape's implementation of the encryption system SSL, and breaking the cryptography in the GSM cellular phone standard. Okay, and here's Dr. Ian Goldberg.
Thanks. So today I'm going to talk about something we call off-the-record messaging, subtitled, or when not to use PGP. This is joint work with Nikita Borisov and Eric Brewer of UC Berkeley, where I did my PhD. So a brief outline. First I'll introduce and motivate the problem. Talk a little about using PGP. I don't know how familiar people are in the audience with the details of public key cryptography signatures. I'll go over that at really high level. There will be no actual math in this talk. If you want actual math, feel free to jump up and down and I'll spew some math at you and you'll go away confused. In general, at any time, if you have any questions, wave your arms around and I'll shoot you with my pointer, and once you get up, you can ask your question and we'll just keep this pretty interactive. Then I'll go on to talk about the problems with PGP. Most people think PGP is great for sending these kinds of secure messages, and I'll point out why, where PGP falls a little short. And then towards a better solution, which we call off-the-record messaging, and I'll explain that more later. To get this better solution, we'll have to introduce some different cryptographic primitives above your basic public key encryption and signatures, and putting it together, and finally we'll conclude. So, introduction. Alice and Bob wish to have a secure private conversation. First, what do we mean? What do we mean by a secure private conversation? Alice and Bob are, of course, our two standard characters. We'll introduce some more standard characters later. What do most people mean when they say secure private conversation, especially in a cryptographic context? Most people mean that no one other than Alice and Bob can read the messages sent between them. Also, that's what we mean by private. By secure, we mean that when Bob receives a message from Alice, he can be assured that Alice is in fact the one who sent it and that it hasn't been modified in transit. Okay, so that's, and vice versa, of course, that when Alice sends a message and when Alice receives a message from Bob, similar things apply. So that's what most people mean if you just ask them, in a cryptographic context, what do you mean by a secure private conversation? Now, how do they go about doing this? Well, Alice and Bob know a thing or two about cryptography. They've read Applied Crypto. So what do? They go get a copy of PGP or GNUPG or whatever your favorite implementation of the RFC is, and they start exchanging messages. Okay, great. We'll even be a little bit generous and assume that they have some way of verifying each other's public keys. So this isn't the problem I'm talking about. I'm not talking about people impersonating public keys and men in the middle like this. I'm talking about more fundamental problems. So we're going to be generous and assume that Alice and Bob even have some secure method to validate each other's public keys. Okay? So off we go. Motivation. So PGP, in fact, satisfies the stated goal. So if you encrypt a message with PGP and send it off, then an eavesdropper can't read it, and if you digitally sign it, then Bob can be assured that Alice, in fact, sent this message and it hasn't been modified in transit. So what's the problem? Problem is the criteria we've listed for a secure private conversation don't really match what we intuitively mean. Right? This is what most people would answer if you ask them, what do you mean by secure private conversation, if they had to formalize it. But intuitively, it doesn't match. And why doesn't it match? Well, it turns out Alice and Bob are still vulnerable to attacks that shouldn't exist in a conversation that really is secure and private in some intuitive sense. And I'm going to formalize that a little more presently. So first I'll talk about PGP and how it works and a little bit about public key crypto. So a quick review of public key concepts in PGP. Public key crypto is like a lockbox that has separate keys for locking and unlocking. Most people are probably familiar with this. Are there people here that have not seen public key crypto before? Great. So I can just go through this quickly. I'm not going to skip it entirely because some of the concepts are useful for analogies later on. So you're familiar, public key crypto is like a lockbox, has separate keys for locking and unlocking. I've seen really cool demonstrations of public key crypto where people actually have a physical lock with physical keys, one of which can lock it, one of which can unlock it, and then you can do all these cool protocols by having people at opposite ends of the stage passing boxes back and forth to each other. And unfortunately, I don't have such cool hardware. So we'll have to pretend, use our imagination. So the important concept is that you can't lock with the unlocking key and you can't unlock with the locking key. Clearly, people knew how to build boxes like this for a long time, but we, and by we I mean the scientific community, I wasn't personally involved, figured out how to do this with mathematics instead of with metal in the 1970s. So we've known about this for a while now. Anyone can generate brand new pairs of locking and unlocking keys. This is an important property. So you can, out of thin air, create a pair of keys, one of which locks the box, one of which unlocks the box. But if you have only one of the keys, you can't derive the other one. Now, this is a little bit stricter than you might think is necessary. You might think it could be okay if you have the unlocking key to be able to derive the locking key, or maybe the other way around. We're going to say, be a little stricter and say that if you have one of the keys, you can't derive the other one. And you'll see why in a bit. But you can see that it's equivalent to any formalism you might have in mind. And in PGP, at least newer versions of PGP, older versions of PGP like version 2 actually got this wrong and have some security weaknesses because of that, but that's not what I'm talking about here. In PGP, the user makes two key pairs, one key pair for encrypting messages and one key pair for signing messages. Okay, and older versions of PGP use the same key pair for both. That actually has security weaknesses involved with it. So, public key encryption. Public key encryption Bob set up is he makes a key pair known as the encryption key pair. He widely publishes copies of the encryption locking key and keeps the unlocking key to himself, just what you'd expect. Now Alice wants to send a message to Bob. What she does is looks up a copy of Bob's locking key, which is widely published, used it to lock her message, sends the message to Bob over a public channel. Eve is our eavesdropper, another of our standard characters. Eve wants to read Alice's messages to Bob. Eve can get hold of Bob's locking key just like anyone else can, but not his unlocking key, because only Bob has that and he doesn't give it out. At least that's the idea. So Eve can't read the message. In fact, not even Alice can read the message she has locked to Bob if she didn't keep a copy of it. If she locks it and forgets what she wrote, she's just as out of luck as Eve is. However, Bob can clearly read the message. He has the unlocking key. He just unlocks it. Okay, digital signatures. This is similar but slightly different. Alice has the setup this time. She makes a key pair, the signature key pair. And this time she widely publishes the unlocking key and keeps the locking key for herself. This is why we don't want to say you can always derive the unlocking key, the locking key from the unlocking key or vice versa, because it makes more sense to talk about signatures in the sense that the unlocking key is the public one and the locking key is the secret one. And why? Well, Alice sends a message to Bob, and In order to sign the message, what she really does is takes the message and locks it using her signature locking key. And then when anyone receives that message, they can check that Alice was the one that locked it by using Alice's unlocking key and seeing if it opens the box. And if it opens the box, then they know that Alice must have been the one that locked the box, because only Alice's locking key is able to lock a box that Alice's unlocking key can open. Okay? So anyone can check that. Also, an additional property is no one could have modified the message. Here the box analogy breaks down a little. You can think of it as if anyone takes this locked box and like pounds it with a hammer, then the unlocking key will jam and not break or something. Okay, the analogy is a little stretched, but the idea is that the unlocking key will only be successful. Bob and anyone else will only be able to unlock the message if the locked box is intact. Okay, so Bob has a guarantee that Alice is in fact the one that signed the message and that it hasn't been modified in transit. Okay, and then just putting it together, in PGP you generally do both. You encrypt and sign. And the way that works is Alice takes the message, locks it once with her own signature key, then takes that, sticks it in another box, and locks that with Bob's encryption key. Okay, so she locks it with her locking key, her signature locking key, which is private. She's the only one with that. And locks it again with Bob's encryption locking key, which is public. Everyone has that. And sends that over the wire. Eve, who might intercept this message, can't unlock the box. Right? Because only Bob, with his unlocking key, can unlock this outer box. And this is important. You might imagine a few different ways you could combine Alice's signature key and Bob's encryption key. You could imagine you take the message and do this. You first sign it and then encrypt it. Or you can imagine you first encrypt it and then sign it. Or there are some cases where you can do kind of both at the same time. And these three scenarios have different security properties, and in different circumstances, you might want to do different ones of them. The reason PGP does it this way, there are a few reasons. One of them is that if you do it the other way, where first you encrypt it and then you sign it, then anyone, even Eve, who can't, even if they can't read the message, can verify that Alice was the one that sent it. Right? And that's often something you might not want. And similarly, if you, like, take one box and put two locks on it that encrypts it and signs it, you also have this property. So PGP does it this way, which for most applications of secure messaging is the correct thing to do. So this isn't the problem I'm getting to. And Bob does, in fact, get these guarantees. So what's the problem? People use this all the time, right? People use PGP. How many people here use PGP? Yeah, that's about what I expect, about half. And you thought you were secure. Okay, so the one sentence bit to take away from this talk is that PGP works really well when nothing goes wrong, but things go wrong. Okay? So what happens if Bob's computer is owned by Carl the Cracker? Right? So Bob's running Windows. Okay? He gets the latest and greatest email worm virus thing. He downloads something off a peer-to-peer system and runs it, or fancy new screensaver with Snow White and however many whatevers, and you've probably gotten all of these emails. So Carl breaks into Bob's computer. Carl can recover Bob's encryption unlocking key. Okay, this is bad, right? The problem is, this is really hard to prevent, right? A lot of this conference is about trying to prevent it. But the other half of the equation is mitigating the badness that can happen once Carl does get in, right? We know we can't perfectly lock out the bad guys, right? So what we want to do is be able to do damage control. We want to keep the amount of mischief that Carl can engage in to a minimum, okay? And this is where PGP falls short. With PGP, basically, what can Carl do? Well, if Bob doesn't realize, there are two cases. If Bob doesn't realize that Carl has owned his computer, then Carl will certainly be able to read all communication from Alice to Bob, right? He just has Bob's unlocking key. Every time Alice sends Bob a message, Carl can copy it and read it. No problem. If Bob does realize it, he can go, okay, and publish a replication and change his key pair. Yep. That's right. So the comment was, if Carl owns Bob's computer, he doesn't even need to read the encrypted message. He can just watch Bob reading it. It's decrypted in the RAM of Bob's computer. But if he takes the key, then even if Bob locks him out, or if he has temporary access to Bob's computer, right, like he walks into Bob's office, copies his disk, and walks out, right, even in a scenario like that where the cracker only has temporary access to Bob's computer, he can still read all future messages until Bob changes his key pair. So there's a lot of badness that can happen. We want to limit how much badness this is. Worse, even if Bob changes his encryption key pair, we have this problem that Carl can read all of Bob's past messages. Right? So if Carl is, say, recording all of the information going to Bob, he can't read it. He just records it because he's part of Carnivore or something. Right? So he just has this big log of all the encrypted bits going to Bob. A year from now, Bob's key is exposed. Carl breaks into it, it's subpoenaed, whatever. Somehow Bob's decryption key is exposed a year from now. Retroactively, all that email becomes insecure. Bob wants to keep out everyone, right? So from the mathematical point of view, there's no difference between good guys and bad guys. Alrighty then. The other badness that Carl can do is unlock the outer box to get the inner signed message and just prove to other people that Alice had written these messages to Bob. Okay? So, what's that? I'm just saying he's gotten his decryption key, not his signature key, just yet. Yeah. This is assuming that Carl has somehow recovered the decryption key. If, like in the case of PGP, the key stored on disk is actually an encrypted form of the decryption key with the passphrase. If Carl can break into Bob's computer, he can put a keystroke logger or whatever and grab the passphrase. I'm assuming if someone owns your computer, you're toast, right? Any secrets that you know and that you type into the computer or that are stored on the computer are now compromised. And, I mean, just ask Scarfo, right? Right, this is not something I'm hypothesizing. This is known technology, so. Okay, so just in summary, this is a really bad one, right? That I'm sending you encrypted messages. I know my machine is secure right now. A year goes by. something changes in my firewall setup, my machine is cracked. Now, retroactively, all my messages are compromised. Okay? This is something we really want to avoid. So, there are two properties PGP doesn't provide that we really want in a conversation that we're going to call secure and private. One is perfect forward secrecy. How many people know about perfect forward secrecy? Okay, some. So, perfect forward secrecy is the assurance that once Bob has received Alice's message and destroyed his copy, okay, so Alice sends a message to Bob, Bob reads it, Bob burns it, right? It should now be impossible for anyone on the planet, including Alice, Bob, Eve, Carl, anyone, to decrypt it later on, right? Even if all of Alice and Bob's secrets become compromised. This is the super strong property we want, right? That PGP, as we've seen, does not provide. So even if all data going from Alice to Bob has been recorded, all the encrypted data, and later on, all of Alice and Bob's secrets are compromised, that encrypted data is not decryptable. Okay? So, I'll talk about how you do that in a bit, but this is just what we mean by perfect forward secrecy. Yeah? So, the question is, isn't this just the data analog of PGP phone? I believe PGP phone does incorporate perfect forward secrecy, in fact. I don't know the protocol off the top of my head, but I would be hard-pressed to design a encrypted voice over IP system that did not have this property. What's that? Using temporary encryption keys and things like that, yeah. It turns out it's not. You would hope that's the case. It turns out that the way the protocol, the way the message format is written precludes you from doing this. There are proposed extensions to the OpenPGP format RFC to enable this, and hopefully they'll go through, certainly. Well, you can't really do that. There are lots of people who really want to do things like time lock cryptography and reverse time lock like that, where you say, you want some way to say, this encrypted data can only be decrypted between this time in the future, right? Turns out that's a really hard thing to do. In order to make sure it's not decryptable until a certain point, the best protocol so far involved things like, don't tell anyone the key and force them to brute force it and just make it hard enough to brute force that it'll take this long, right? So the way to make it undecryptable after a certain date, after a certain specific time, often involves things like trusted time servers and things like that. But I don't know of any protocol like that that has a high degree of security. If you have a trusted third party, you can do things like that. Then your trusted third party can always read the message, though. You have to trust them, hence the name. Well, depends how you implement it. If the trusted third party is only there to provide clock service, then yeah, you can spoof it. If the way the protocol works is I hand the clear text message to the trusted third party, and to decrypt it, you ask the trusted third party for it, and the trusted third party, if it's in the right time, tells it to you, and if it's not, he says no. Right? Right? That's a very simple protocol involving a trusted third party for this. But we want to avoid trusted third parties, because it turns out they're not all that trustworthy most of the time. Funny that. Okay, the other property we really want for a secure private conversation is called repudiability. And this is the ability for Alice to deny that she wrote any particular message. Okay? Now, this is a little different from what most people know if they learn cryptography from something like Applied Crypto or on the net, right? Most of the time when you learn about cryptography, it's pounded into you, you really want non-repudiability. Non-repudiability is good, right? So that's why we have digital signatures. Great for electronic contracts where you don't want people to get out of getting out of what they wrote. It's not good for private communication, right? If I'm having a secret discussion with you, I don't want a proof signed by me of that discussion, right? That really is the opposite of what we want here. So we want repudiability, not non-repudiability. You might think that Alice could just get repudiability simply by using PGP and not signing the message, right? Problem is then, Bob isn't even assured of the authenticity of the message, and it's no longer secure. Then the message is forgeable, and you lose the security properties. No, not necessarily. Those are two separate things. You could still have your standard signature block on a message, and the encryption envelope is done with forward secrecy. So it turns out that's a little bit hard. You can do it right. I'm not sure if the various proposals going forward now provide repudiability or not. Let me think about it a little more. I'd have to read them again. I can't answer that question right now. But it's not necessarily the case that it would do it, but it's certainly true that without much more work, you can achieve it. And in fact, I'm going to show you how to do that. So, yeah. Why, yes. And I'll get to that just in a bit. It's not quite a, the question was, isn't repudiability and confirming the authenticity of a message a paradox? And the answer is, it's not quite a paradox, and there's a loophole that we're going to escape through, but I'll get to that in just a few slides. Yep. So, as I said, I'll get to this in a bit. Bob wants to be assured that Alice wrote the message. Alice wants to be able to deny that she wrote the message to later on. Yeah, and all this fudging of words is, you'll see where the loophole is. Always a good point, and always Alice can take any non-repudiable system and say, well, I didn't sign it, my computer signed it, and someone broke into it. Alice now has a larger burden of proof, as it were, to a larger hurdle to claim that she didn't write it. Because now she has to claim that someone, in fact, broke into her computer and stole her secrets. In a truly repudiable system, it's that anyone in the world could have written this message without knowing any secrets that Alice holds. Okay. So, we have what we're going to call off-the-record messaging. And the idea is that two people have an off-the-record conversation, right? Someone's whistleblowing to a reporter or whatever and wants no record that this conversation ever took place. It certainly should not be the case that a day or a week later the conversation is decryptable by anyone. It should certainly not be the case that there is some signed proof that this conversation took place. Once the conversation is over, it's gone. It's just some The conversation, any possible record of the conversation should have been turned into random bits that are no longer recoverable. Okay? So, in particular, some properties we want. If no one was actively listening in at the time the conversation took place, and the reason we have to have this disclaimer is that if Carl has owned Bob's computer while he's communicating with Alice, clearly he can read the message, right? There's nothing we can do about that. The question is, can he be sure if Carl owns Alice's box, can he be sure Bob sent the message? And if Alice can be sure, then he can be sure. Right? So, but if no one was actively listening in at the time the conversation was taking place, then the conversation's contents are secure forever. Then we have another caveat that what if Alice or Bob is a snitch and intentionally reveals the conversation? Turns out we're going to deal with this case as well. We want to prevent, even if Bob is a snitch, we want to make as little badness as possible happen. And we'll see how little we can make that about this. And we'll talk about this right now. So even if Bob goes to some third-party Trent with the contents of the conversation, we want it to be the case that even though Bob was assured that Alice had written the message, if Bob shows the message to Trent, Trent is not so assured. Trent has to take Bob's word for it. Bob could have made up this whole conversation out of whole cloth. But Bob could have modified his software, right? Bob could have modified his software to put up any screens he wants and videotapes it. Oh, absolutely. But if no one has compromised Bob's computer, which is this caveat here, then Bob is actually assured that the conversation is secure. No, even if Bob's a snitch, he is still assured the conversation is secure. At the end of the day, Trent has to trust that Bob has cooperated in the way he's supposed to cooperate. Right? The point is that Alice, from a protocol point of view, can deny anything, and Bob could have written any message that he shows to Trent. Right. So, Trent can't be assured that Alice's messages are authentic. We want that to be the case. However, Bob needs to be assured that Alice's messages are authentic. And this is this apparent paradox, right? So in order to achieve these goals, and in particular the last two, which really look conflicting at first glance, we're going to need to use cryptographic techniques a little more esoteric than plain public key encryption and signatures. And all of you have seen public key encryption and signatures before. Not all of you may have seen some of these other things. So, first one, I've already mentioned perfect forward secrecy. This is ensuring that key compromise can't be used to recover past messages. The second technique we're going to use is called message authentication codes. This allows Alice and Bob to be assured of the authenticity of each other's messages without Trent being able to be so assured. And the third thing is malleable encryption. And this allows anyone to easily modify transcripts of encrypted conversations, and this further aids Alice's repudiability. Okay, so I'll talk about each of these in turn in quite a bit of detail. Okay, first, perfect forward secrecy. So, Carl has compromised either Alice's or Bob's computer. If he does this at the time a message is being composed and sent, or received in red, he can clearly read the message, right? Nothing we can do can prevent this from happening. The question was, if the encryption is malleable, which I haven't actually talked about yet, but in a repudiable system, the question is, he's not assured that Alice was in fact the one who sent it. And the answer is, if Bob is so assured, then Alice is so assured. If Bob is so assured, then Carl is so assured. Because the thing, as we'll see in a bit, the thing that makes the repudiability work is that Bob can cheat, right? If Carl's just watching what Bob's doing, he can tell that Bob's not cheating, right? And if he's watching at the time, he can tell that Bob's not cheating and he's assured that Alice is in fact the one who wrote the message. If Carl wasn't watching at the time and Bob just shows him or Trent a copy of the message, Bob could have cheated. And we'll talk in a bit about how this cheating happened. The question is this true even if Carl records all state that happens inside the encryption and decryption process? And the answer is yes. The problem is that Bob is going to be able to create identical messages to the ones Alice created. Okay. So, if Carl has compromised a computer, then any messages going through at that time clearly are compromised. Nothing we can do there. But once the compromise is detected and corrected, so once Carl is locked out again and Bob changes his keys, future messages should not be exposed. Alice and Bob should be able to resume communication and Carl should not be able to read them. This means, in particular, that encryption key material has to be generated freshly and not derived from some stored state. So this is basically saying, change your encryption keys often, right? But it's a little more subtle than that. You can't just do things like add one to your old encryption key to get your new encryption key or hash your old encryption key to get your new encryption key. And you shouldn't laugh. There are protocols in existence out there that do exactly that. They change encryption keys simply by hashing your old one. They do it for a different reason. The reason they do it is often if you have a lot of traffic encrypted under one key, then that can help you encrypt analysis. So what the system does is not assuming that someone has cracked the system and recovered today's key, but rather they just hash the key every day so that there's a limited amount of material ever encrypted under one encryption key. But a system like that, even though it does change the keys regularly, does not satisfy this property. Because if Carl breaks in and gets today's key, he automatically knows all keys for the future. In addition, a compromise must never expose past messages, right? So if you're simply adding one to the encryption key every day, then if I break in today, I also know all past encryption keys, and that's even worse. So in order to get perfect forward secrecy, we require that if Carl breaks in and then is locked out again, he's allowed to be able to read any messages that are sent or received during that time that he was in the computer, but nothing before that and nothing after that. Derive some properties that are logical consequences of our definition of perfect forward secrecy. If a compromise must not expose the contents of past messages, then it has to be the case that the encryption keys to those past messages not only aren't in the box anymore, but can't even be calculated from any information in the box. Right? So any encryption key for last week's messages is gone. Right? It's not only not stored in the box, it's not on the hard disk, it's not in your swap file. Right? It's not even derivable from any material there. Okay, so that's an important property. In particular, you need to frequently change the keys. How frequently? As frequently as possible is the short, glib answer. In practice, changing keys has a cost, and you have to balance that cost against what you're doing, what you're securing. Security is economics. I mean, this is a pretty standard argument. It turns out it's not very expensive. I'll talk a little more about the cost of changing keys in a minute. But it turns out it's often not unreasonable to use a different encryption key pair for every message that you send. Yeah. That's correct. Yep. And if you think of an instant message setting or something like that, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And especially if you think about the kinds of conversations we're talking about, that's an extremely reasonable thing to want to happen, right? Yeah. How do you validate? The question is, if you're always changing keys, how do you validate them? And I'll talk about that in just a bit. The question is, how can Alice trust that Bob is actually forgetting his old keys? And the answer to that is that Alice can't necessarily trust Bob, but that just reduces to the case that Bob is a snitch and is voluntarily breaking the protocol in order to reveal more information, which we deal with separately. Okay? Right. And as I mentioned earlier, the keys need to have a large fresh random component, each key, right? You can't just take the hash of the current time and some master secret to get a key, because then past and or future keys will be derivable from state that's currently on the box. So to make a key, you pick some randomness out of your favorite real random number generator, like you have a radioactive source plugged into your computer, right? Everyone has one of those. No? Oh, well. We'll get one soon. Intel motherboards have one of those, right? It's not radioactive. But. So you get real randomness. You use that as the key, or combine that with something. Use that as the key. And once you very well scrub and erase that memory, it's no longer recoverable by any means. So that's really what you want. Okay, the costs of perfect forward secrecy. How expensive is it to change keys? The answer, as always, is it depends. If you're using something like RSA for your encryption mechanism, key pair generation is pretty expensive.